Mr. Martin, Reel 18. We were talking about this action where they were taking up positions, the Germans were approaching, and this rifle brigade officer with anti-tank guns was, rather from the sound of it, getting in the way. And you said he moved and was giving orders.
Well, I warned him that the blast from the 17 pounder when it fired was quite something unpleasant, and I didn't want his crew getting injured by the blast from it. So he moved it just a little bit away, and he said to his crew, he said, "When I say Robin, get ready to move. When I say now, move." In other words, to leave the gun and clear away. Well, as it transpired later on, he didn't need to say now, because he'd move by the time we got the word Robin, when the gun went off. However, we were prepared for this column moving up. Now, you can imagine the tension, long after midnight in the early hours, when the gun sights are useless in the dark, and we wanted flares. So I said to this young fellow, when he moved his gun, I said, "There's one thing we want," I said, "and that's for flares. Can you arrange for flares for us to fire by?" He said, "That's all being arranged." He said, "There should be no problem." He said, "When the fun starts," he said, "the flares will go up." I said, "So long as you're all keyed up for that," and that's all that matters. Well, the tension was absolutely electric there. We were all sitting watching, listening for this thing coming up. And it was getting louder and louder. The squadron leader was there. And down the road, we could see a German motorcycle had come and passed the blazing tank, or the burning tank, fire was dying down with it then, stopped, he got up and moved a bit. And a moment later, round the side came a Mark IV special tank, a German. And once we saw that, we knew there was armour involved, and we were ready. And just at that moment, who should come along the road but our quartermaster with his 1500 weights? Came in, saw us on the right, came in, saw the squadron leader there. "Well, you can always rely on good old Quarty bringing the supplies up," out loud to the squadron leader. One of the leaders said, "Quartermaster, come here with you. Did you see that lot down there with that blazing tank?" "Yes," he said, "I saw them." He said, "What are they doing down there anyway?" He said, "If I told you they were Germans, what would you say?" "What? I'm clearing out from here now." That's what the leader said, quoting, "You get your vehicles in that cemetery and keep out of the way, because the fun is going to start any moment now." How the Germans didn't see him coming along that road, I'll never know. But they were looking at that tank. They were planning. In order to get past, they got to move that. And they set to work. They put the tow rope from their tank onto the blazing tank and pulled it off the road. And that meant there were wheel vehicles, obviously, you see, as well as the tank. They pulled it away, and the quartermaster got his vehicles in the cemetery out of our way. And we just sat waiting. Now, we realised there was a knocked-out tank on the road, and my thoughts of that was that the German troop commander or the tank commander would see that on the road, silhouetted, and immediately think it was a British tank, and he got the fire up. So working on that basis, I saw my sergeant, I said, "As soon as he comes close," I said, "don't fire until he's really close. Make sure you hit him first time." Well, the German tank came along, and from my position on the other side of the house, looking at the side of the column, I could see the tank in the front. There was a big anti-tank gun, the 88 behind it, being towed, and there was a transport behind that with troops sitting on the back of it, and there was vehicles behind them, but I couldn't see what they were. But I could just see the tank, and I could see the second one by the light of the blazing tank. Well, we waited, and we let the German come along. You know, the tension was absolutely electric. Wondering how long it was going to be before he fired, because we thought he'd fired at the tank on the road. And suddenly he stopped about 70 yards down the road. And of course, the sergeant wasn't going to train right on him. And at that moment, the German put a flare up. It illuminated the whole scene. At the moment he put the flare up, he fired at the tank on the road. His aim was too high, because his aim hit the top of the Sherman turret, which is slightly rounded, and I heard that shell thump and ricochet away. And when it ricocheted, there was a beautiful noise, and it shot off into the distance. At that same moment, of course, when the flare went up and the German fired at the tank, my sergeant fired at the German tank, and it hit it right through the turret. I fired at the ones behind, and my sergeant fired another shell into the forward compartment, into the engine of the German tank, which went right through into the engine. They're being so close and being a 17 pounder, and it started to catch fire. The German tank did. We fired at all the vehicles behind, and the close support tank from squadron headquarters, which was behind us, sheltered in the trees, that fired down the road onto the troops and the, you know, people in the background, because there was quite a number of vehicles in the background. And there was quite a commotion. There was a, you can imagine it. Flares went up from the rifle brigade, because after the first flare died away, the rifle brigade put their flares up, so we continued by the light of flares for the action. And it's lasted, I suppose, went across an hour or so, not long. But it was quite an action while it landed. Noise and shells flying all over the place. But it ended suddenly. And we couldn't see, sadly, what was going on down the road, because it was pitch dark, you see. And the flares didn't last very long. And they didn't, once the battle's finished, they didn't fire anymore. So what went on, I would imagine, a lot of the rear of the column turned round and fled down the road. But the next day they came in as prisoners, actually, because there was no way they could get over the river. The other bridges were blown, so they came and gave them some of it. But that ended the night battle. And by that time, we were back, I suppose, after 3 or 4 in the morning.
Could you just explain what happened to the infantry 6-pounder crew? Cause
well, I don't know what happened, because we were so busy firing, you see, that we were firing at the column on the main road. And all I remember is that the enemy, the 6-pounder gun was down to our left. They didn't fire a shot, actually, because I said to the chap, I said, we can manage with our 17-pounders. I don't think there's any likelihood that we'll be knocked out and we'll take over. But before, we'd only fired one shot, and the blast was such that they realised the strength of it. And the infantry officer apparently said, Robin, by the time he said Robin, there wasn't a crewman to be seen, it all disappeared. Soon as the blast from the 17-pounder went off, because we fired several rounds, obviously, and they weren't having any more of it.
Now, what happened next morning then?
Well, next morning, I went over, and well, before I went over to see the squadron leader, I looked at the farm. There's a farm about 400 yards down the road, on the left-hand side, 200 or 300 yards from the road in the field. And I looked at that farm through my binoculars, and I could see into a barn, and there looked to be a couple of vehicles in there. So I wondered what they were, and I thought, I'd like to go and see. So I sort of went over to the squadron leader, and as I went over to the squadron leader, somebody shouted, look out, sir, they're sniping at us. So I heard a bullet whine past, and I said, where? He said, across the river there. He said, there's a column of them. He said, most of them are behaving themselves, but some are being awkward. And a few, the aggressive types were firing rifles across, trying to shoot somebody. So I went to see the squadron leader, and I told him what I'd seen in this farm. I said, can I take a honey over and half a dozen chaps and have a look down there? Oh, he said, by all means, if there's any vehicles worth looking at, bring them over. I said, right. He said, be careful. I said, well, there's sniping going on. He said, I'm going to machine gun them, and if that doesn't stop, I'm going to use AT on them. So I just went towards my troop, and I heard the tanks at the front firing machine guns over, and it was a column on the far side of the river, but it was mostly horse-drawn transport. There wasn't much in the way of vehicles, so I assumed then that the shortage of petrol, you see, was affecting them. So I took a Connie and six chaps down to the farm came in from an angle so that they weren't likely to be trapped at all. Got down to the farm, stopped about 20 yards outside the front door, and just mounted. And an Italian chap came out to meet the farmer. And I asked him if there were any Germans around, and so he said, no, they're all gone. So I sent two chaps in the farm, had a look around, make sure, and they came out and said, no, they're all clear. So I said, who left the vehicles in there? When did they come? He said, last night. I said, well, afternoon. So, did they put any mines or did they do anything like that to them, do you think? So he said, no. He said, he indicated to me that they came in, jumped out and ran off. He said, stop after them, ran away. So I saw, and I had two mechanics with me among the two of the party. So I said, will you check the vehicle and see if there's not any booby traps or anything before you start up? Oh, yes, we'll check that. So they went over and looked at them. And one was a beautifully fitted out fitter's truck. It was absolutely gorgeous. It was a big box-like affair. And the inside was a little miniature work truck with lathes and all sorts of stuff. It was just what the fitters wanted. The other one was a half track with rocket firing equipment on the back of it. Now, these were the two vehicles that had been dumped in this farm. So I said, right, we'll take them back. I said, are you sure there's no booby traps? Oh, he said, quite sure everything's clear. He said, I'm quite sure there's no problem. So I said, right then, start up, come over. Let's start again, talk to them. And we took them back. Just what I'm back for. Scott Neal was very pleased. He said, do you still do this? You for us, what in headquarters? Fetters that, Fetters. Yeah, Fetters truck, well. But it didn't last long because maybe the headquarters heard about it and they took it. And the half track with the rocket gun, the intelligence people came to check that one over, and they took the rocket off it, and they went back for examination, and they left the half track there for us. But that was interesting to get those. But there was lots of debris down the road, and the tank was just burned out, wrecked the one that we knocked out, the German Mark IV. We didn't stay there that long. We stayed there that day.
What about German prisoners? Were they in evidence?
Yeah, late that afternoon, because it was in the morning, I went over to pick the trucks up when I saw them. I took them back and had a chat with the squadron leader about them. And somehow the messengers had gone to RHQ because the tech adj came over from RHQ and said, I'm afraid that I must take these because these are just what we want. The Hitler's truck particularly is ideal.
But what was the state of the German POWs when you got when you saw them?
Well, I noticed that none of them had weapons. I often wondered where those weapons went to. But they came in trucks, and they didn't seem to be too bad. Some of them were looking very dejected, and I thought that they realised, from their point of view, the war was over. There was no alternative. They came in trucks, truck after truck came up, and the Rifle Brigade sort of made a square where all these prisoners were put into the square. Commissioned officers were segregated from the other ranks and taken for questioning. But they formed a great area where these POWs were kept in. And the trucks, they came in trucks as well, quite a lot of them. Some of them walked in. I don't know how many hundreds there were, but they kept coming in the afternoon. Quite a lot of them. I didn't take any pictures of them because I haven't got the camera there, but somebody else did. I've seen a picture of them in the trucks coming in.
Now, the next thing is you started, back end of April, you started to move up to the Po.
That's right, yes.
Was there any opposition, or was this just a...
No, there was no opposition. The Germans had gone to... The column that we were attacking were heading for the Po, but we cut them off completely. The Germans who were the north of the Po, that would be the group who knocked out C Squadron, they hightailed it out because they realised their war was over south of the Po. Many of them tried to cross the Po and didn't make it. They were either killed or drowned. Because we, shortly after that battle went on to the banks of the Po. And we formed, as you see in the picture in the book, three lines, one on near the top with the 17-pounder tanks and the others down below. We made tented camp and we were there for, maybe a week or so. And there were one or two bodies floating down the river, the Po, because they'd tried to swim across. Someone tried to get across in boats. Well, of course, there were soldiers on the banks to the south side, shooting them down as they went. And a lot of them drowned, I'm afraid, that tried to cross the Po. Others who didn't were captured, of course, and became POW. Now, we had no problem getting to the Po at all. And we stayed there for a few days. And then we were ordered to change over to armoured cars very quickly.
This before the end of the war?
No, this was just after the end of the war.
What about the end of the war, then? Because, V-Day or whenever you first found out?
2nd of July, I think, VI Day. We were on the banks of the Po. We were relaxing. And we'd heard that there was very little opposition on the north side of the Po. The enemy seemed to have disappeared altogether. I took a wander along the flood bank and down towards the Po itself, which was on the opposite side from our tank. And I just stood watching the river. I could see a few bodies on sandbanks in the river. There were one or two little sandbanks, and there were one or two bodies sort of lapped by the water there. And it was a lovely afternoon, and I can't think that this war is going to go on in history for very much longer. And suddenly the corporal, my corporal, dashed on him. Sir, have you had the good news? No, what good news? War in Italy's over. I think that was the 2nd of July. War in Italy's over.
2nd of May, probably.
I'm sorry, May. May, that's right. War in Italy's over, and all opposition is finished. That's in Italy. I said, well, I'm delighted to hear that. So I just sat, I'll be along in a minute, so I just sat down by the tree and give a sigh of relief and thought, I wonder what the next stage would be, because obviously war in Germany hadn't finished, war in Japan come to that. So I sat for about 10 minutes, I think, just enjoying the sunshine, and I went back to the troop. But we had a chat, of course, and we decided we'd have a bite to eat, and await orders to see what was going to happen then, because obviously something would happen if we go somewhere. And we stayed for 3 or 4 days like that, and then the instructions came through that we would be going to Austria under the border of the Yugoslavia, and that 2 squadrons would change the armoured cars, and the 3rd squadron would retain the tanks. A and B would go to armoured cars, C would retain the tanks, so we would go into armoured cars, and we'd go to get Staghounds, which were American armoured cars. And they'd seen service before. They were battered other things when they came. So,
what did you think of the Staghounds after your Shermans?
Didn't like them at all. Ready with a pea shooter in the turret that they'd got. Little 37mm. But they were fast. They got power steering. The only snag with that was, if you went to a curb, it would climb the curb and be over it. Power steering came into action. So there was a resistance, you see, coming back from Austria to Milan, one armoured car hit the curb, went over it and went down embankment, somebody was killed in it, which just showed the power of the power steering coming into action. So we took over these armoured cars, and the next stage was that they decided that we get a little bit of training in because we were not used to it. And the drivers particularly, they wanted to change. The turret crew, the war was over, all we would operate the wireless. There was no firing and guns out of order, but they were useless anyway. And they were not allowed to encounter any Germans. So it was a case of drivers only getting their training again. And they did that locally. They were competent drivers, obviously, and they should have been used to the armoured cars. We painted signs for the front. It had the regimental crest on, it had the squadron crest, and it had the divisional sign on. And these were fastened on by the fitted onto the front of the armoured car. And they painted a square on, or a circle, according to the squadron. we were all ready to go. And then the next thing was we were getting orders to go to a little place called Eisenkappel in Austria.
Eisenkappel.
Eisenkappel, yes. This was right on the border with Yugoslavia in Carinthia. So we had quite a journey. We went to Udine, across the border into Austria. And this was pretty then.
Will this be still May or in winter, June?
Pardon?
When would this be?
I would think, I can't remember actually, but I would think it would be May, the end of the war. I think it would be about the end of May, towards the end of May. By the time we got the armoured cars, kitted them out, done the signs, and had a bit of practice with them, it would be getting towards the end of May. And we set off for Austria, and as I say, it was right on the border with Yugoslavia, in Carinthia, the south-east border. Now, there'd been trouble with the partisans there, who'd been raiding that part from Yugoslavia, Austria, taking cattle and anything else that took their fancy. And our job was to stop it, for one thing, protect the Austrians from the raids, to see if there were any German soldiers who'd thrown away their uniforms and gone to work on farms, and especially to see if there were any SS who had dumped the uniform and gone to puppy farm labourers, and also to check houses to make sure there were no military weapons available. Shotguns were all right, they were natural farmers' weapons, you see, but it was the military weapons that we got after, in case there were any around. That was our instruction. Well, it was a long journey to the border, and Eisenkappel was a lovely little village, peaceful and quiet after the war, but getting used to it, actually. But the mess that we were in to begin with, the junior officers had one little bungalow, the occupants of which, apparently, so the locals, had been taken into Yugoslavia by the partisans. So that was unoccupied, and that bungalow that we had for the junior officers. And there was a bigger one for the senior officers in the regiment, what was like a short, small spot.
And where were the men?
The men were billeted in the school in the town. And any other large buildings they took over. Requisition, of course, was leaving us. And we are not allowed to patronise with the local population in theory anyway.
I think I'll come up. What about these roles you had? What about dealing with the Yugoslav partisans? What did you do about that?
Well, I, on the patrol that I went, I never came across any. But other troop leaders did. They had a bit of trouble with some of them. One arrived at a village with a cluster of houses, a hamlet really. He arrived and one of the locals came along one warning because the Yugoslav partisan party coming up. So this chap with his troop, he just stood there with about four chaps and the rest of them, he got up in the windows of the houses and he had them waiting so that when the partisans came up, all that they saw was the officer and about four men. Well, they thought we'd made it here, come running to us, and they became a little bit argumentative about what we were going to do. So this troop leader said, you will just clear out from here, go back into Yugoslavia. We don't want any trouble with you, but if you're determined to cause trouble, just have a look round. And from all the windows, the chaps have got their rifles pointed at them. So they realised that discretion was the better part of valour. And they also knew that they were in the wrong place. They ought not to have been there anyway, you see. So they disappeared. And that was the only encounter that I know of that took place between our squadron and the partisans.
Now, what about the other role, which is the patrols looking for weapons and Nazis?
Well, now, they were rather more difficult because we had to be off before dawn and get to the farms by dawn, because they were up and about early on farms, and if they knew we were coming or saw us, they'd be aware. So we wanted to be up there by dawn, and you went as far as you could by jeep, and then you had to walk the rest, and it was all much fun. I've got some nice photographs of it, actually. But you've got to be very careful, because some of them had got German troops there. One or two had done the uniform and on civilian clothing and working. Well, now, you knew the moment you looked at them that age, whether they were German troops or not, because the Germans cleared all the young men of fighting age away from the villages, and only the old men, young boys, and the severely disabled were in the villages, on the male population. That was a good indication. When you found these young fellows, they were taken in for questioning. No question about it, in you come, like it or not. So I mean, they were fed, no matter what they were wearing, what they were doing, they were taken in for questioning. I think there were one or two only who were SS. Only one or two, as far as I heard. I didn't think they were. There were some Ustashi about, as you know, the Ustashi. They were the white Russians. And I felt rather sorry that they got taken in and handed in because they were attacked to certain death.
Did you see anything of that process?
I didn't see anything of it at all. We simply did the work of collecting them.
That's right. Well, how did you go about collecting them?
Well, we just said, you are coming with us, because we were armed, obviously. And they had no option but to come with us, because to come in, like it or not, those were our orders. We couldn't let them wander around, even though we may have disagreed with the eventual end of many of them.
How were they handed over? Were they handed over in your time?
No.
To the Russians?
I didn't see anything of that. We simply took them in to squadron headquarters in Eisenhower. And the people there, and there were other units as well there, who looked after that side of it. Our job was mainly to visit the farms and do the patrols in the hills.
Did he find many weapons?
No, not very many at all. One or two isolated rifles. They were rather older ones, I thought, not the modern German army weapons. Quite a lot of shotguns and things like that, which were permissible, of course, because they were sort of farmers' weapons. But in the main, I found the people very helpful. In the town itself, you see, it seemed that my troop used to get the job of visiting the farms of the patrols. Other troops in the town, in the same squadron, they visited the houses, and what I was told by them, the Germans had stacked in the houses suitcases of trophies which they plundered from various other places and taken them into the houses and said, you keep these until we come for them. But of course they never went for them because the army was defeated. But our troops went in and we demanded to know what was in every item that was in the house and where there was loot, which was obvious, jewelry and stuff like that, and you know, silverware, anything like that. Was questionable, and then they were interrogated to where it came from. But that was not done by me, that was done by another friend of mine who was actually involved in that, visiting the houses to see what there was in the houses in the way of loot. But that wasn't my job, I was the one who was going down the farm.
And what about this non-fraternisation business? How was that?
Well, in theory it worked, in practice it didn't, because obviously. We had occasion when we got to speak to the locals, and I don't think anybody wanted to be overbearing and, what should we say, very unpleasant about the whole business. The war was over, and these were the people who lived at home. They may have had sons in the army, many of them haven't lost them, but at least the people there went out of the way, I thought, to be friendly and helpful if we wanted anything. They would be quite prepared to help and do anything. And they were, some of them were actually sort of employed in menial positions in the houses or in the schools, cleaning and so on. So in the main, I found them quite affable. Some of the men, I think, found sort of second homes in some of the houses there, naturally. In fact, I know one chap who had two children before he got married to a German Austrian girl. But, you know, I mean, nature will take its course, let's face it. And there were occasions when many of them found family friends and they often used to go and see them.